The Awakening by Kate Chopin. Continued.
Disc 2.
11.
What are you doing out here, Edna? I thought I should find you in bed, said her husband when he discovered her lying there. He had walked up with Madame Lebrun and left her at the house. His wife did not reply.
Are you asleep?
He asked, bending down close to look at her. No. Her eyes gleamed bright and intense, with no sleepy shadows as they looked into his.
Do you know it is past 1 o'clock? Come on.
And he mounted the steps and went into their room.
Edna!
Called Mr. Pontellier from within after a few moments had gone by. Don't wait for me, she answered. He thrust his head through the door.
You will take cold out there, he said irritably. What folly is this? Why don't you come in?
It isn't cold. I have my shawl.
The mosquitoes will devour you.
There are no mosquitoes. She heard him moving about the room, every sound indicating impatience and irritation. Another time she would have gone in at his request. She would, through habit, have yielded to his desire, not with any sense of submission or obedience to his compelling wishes, but unthinkingly, as we walk, move, sit, stand, go through the daily treadmill of the life which has been portioned out to us.
Edna, dear, are you not coming in soon?
He asked again, this time fondly, with a note of entreaty. No, I'm going to stay out here.
This is more than folly, he blurted out. I can't permit you to stay out there all night. You must come in this house instantly.
With a writhing motion, she settled herself more securely in the hammock. She perceived that her will had blazed up, stubborn and resistant. She could not at that moment have done other than denied and resisted. She wondered if her husband had ever spoken to her like that before, and if she had submitted to his command. Of course she had. She remembered that she had. But she could not realize why or how she should have yielded, feeling as she then did. Léonce, go to bed, she said. I mean to stay out here. I don't wish to go in, and I don't intend to. Don't speak to me like that again. I shall not answer you. Mr. Pontellier had prepared for bed, but he slipped on an extra garment. He opened a bottle of wine, of which he kept a small and select supply in a buffet of his own. He drank a glass of the wine and went out on the gallery and offered a glass to his wife. She did not wish any. He drew up the rocker, hoisted his slippered feet on the rail, and proceeded to smoke a cigar. He smoked 2 cigars. Then he went inside and drank another glass of wine. Mrs. Pontellier again declined to accept a glass when it was offered to her. Mr. Pontellier once more seated himself with elevated feet, and after a reasonable interval of time smoked some more cigars. Edna began to feel like one who awakens gradually out of a dream, a delicious, grotesque, impossible dream, to feel again the realities pressing into her soul. The physical need for sleep began to overtake her. The exuberance which had sustained and exalted her spirit left her helpless and yielding to the conditions which crowded her in. The stillest hour of the night had come, the hour before dawn, when the world seems to hold its breath. The moon hung low and had turned from silver to copper in the sleepy sky. The old owl no longer hooted, and the water oaks had ceased to moan as they bent their heads. Edna arose, cramping from lying so long and still in the hammock. She tottered up the steps, clutching feebly at the post before passing into the house. Are you coming in, Léonce? She asked, turning her face toward her husband.
Yes, dear, he answered, with a glance following a misty puff of smoke. Just as soon as I finish my cigar.
12. She slept but a few hours. They were troubled and feverish hours, disturbed with dreams that were intangible, that eluded her, leaving only an impression upon her half-awakened senses of something unattainable. She was up and dressed in the cool of the early morning. The air was invigorating and steadied somewhat her faculties. However, she was not seeking refreshment or help from any source, either external or from within. She was blindly following whatever impulse moved her, as if she had placed herself in alien hands for direction and freed her soul of responsibility. Most of the people at that early hour were still in bed and asleep.
A few who intended to go over to the Chenière for Mass were moving about. The lovers, who had laid their plans the night before, were already strolling toward the wharf. The lady in black, with her Sunday prayer book, velvet and gold clasped, and her Sunday silver beads, was following them at no great distance. Old Monsieur Farival was up, and was more than half inclined to do anything that suggested itself. He put on his big straw hat, and taking his umbrella from the stand in the hall, followed the lady in black, never overtaking her. The little Negro girl who worked Madame Lebrun's sewing machine was sweeping the galleries with long, absent-minded strokes of the broom. Edna sent her up into the house to awaken Robert. "Tell him I am going to the Chenière. The boat is ready. Tell him to hurry." He had soon joined her. She had never sent for him before. She had never asked for him. She had never seemed to want him before. She did not appear conscious that she had done anything unusual in commanding his presence. He was apparently equally unconscious of anything extraordinary in the situation. But his face was suffused with a quiet glow when he met her. They went together back to the kitchen to drink coffee. There was no time to wait for any nicety of service. They stood outside the window, and the cook passed them their coffee and a roll, which they drank and ate from the windowsill. Edna said it tasted good. She had not thought of coffee, nor of anything. He told her he had often noticed that she lacked forethought. "Wasn't it enough to think of going to the Chenière and waking you up?" she laughed. "Do I have to think of everything?" as Leon says when he's in a bad humor. I don't blame him. He'd never be in a bad humor if it weren't for me. They took a short cut across the sands. At a distance they could see the curious procession moving toward the wharf, the lovers, shoulder to shoulder, creeping, the lady in black gaining steadily upon them, old Monsieur Farival losing ground inch by inch, and a young barefooted Spanish girl with a red kerchief on her head and a basket on her arm bringing up the rear. Robert knew the girl, and he talked to her a little in the boat. No one present understood what they said. Her name was Mariquita. She had a round, sly, piquant face and pretty black eyes. Her hands were small, and she kept them folded over the handle of her basket. Her feet were broad and coarse. She did not strive to hide them. Edna looked at her feet and noticed the sand and slime between her brown toes. Beaudelet grumbled because Mariquita was there, taking up so much room. In reality, he was annoyed at having old Monsieur Farival, who considered himself the better sailor of the two. But he would not quarrel with so old a man as Monsieur Farival, so he quarreled with Mariquita. The girl was deprecatory at one moment, appealing to Robert. She was saucy the next, moving her head up and down, making eyes at Robert and making mouths at Beaudelet. The lovers were all alone. They saw nothing, they heard nothing. The lady in black was counting her beads for the third time. Old Monsieur Farival talked incessantly of what he knew about handling a boat, and of what Beaudelet did not know on the same subject. Edna liked it all. She looked Mariquita up and down, from her ugly brown toes to her pretty black eyes, and back again. "Why does she look at me like that?" inquired the girl of Robert. "Maybe she thinks you're pretty. Shall I ask her?"
"No." "Is she your sweetheart?"
"She's a married lady and has two children."
"Oh, well. Francisco ran away with Silvano's wife, who had four children. They took all his money and one of the children and stole his boat."
"Shut up."
"Does she understand?"
"Oh, hush."
"Are those two married over there, leaning on each other?"
"Of course not," laughed Robert.
"Of course not,"
echoed Mariquita with a serious, confirmatory bob of the head. The sun was high up and beginning to bite. The swift breeze seemed to Edna to bury the sting of it into the pores of her face and hands. Robert held his umbrella over her. As they went cutting sidewise through the water, the sails bellied taut, and the wind filing and overflowing them. Old Monsieur Farival laughed sardonically at something as he looked at the sails, and Beaudelet swore at the old man under his breath. Sailing across the bay to the Chenière Caminada, Edna felt as if she were being borne away from some anchorage which had held her fast, whose chains had been loosening, had snapped the night before when the mystic spirit was abroad, leaving her free to drift whithersoever she chose to set her sails. Robert spoke to her incessantly. He no longer noticed Mariquita. The girl had shrimps in her bamboo basket. They were covered with Spanish moss. She beat the moss down impatiently and muttered to herself sullenly. Let us go to Grande-Terre tomorrow, said Robert in a low voice.
What shall we do there?
Climb up the hill to the old fort and look at the little wriggling gold snakes and watch the lizards sun themselves. She gazed away toward Grande-Terre and thought she would like to be alone there with Robert in the sun, listening to the ocean's roar and watching the slimy lizards writhe in and out among the ruins of the old fort. And the next day or the next we can sail to the Bayou Brulot, he went on. What shall we do there? Anything? Cast bait for fish? No, we'll go back to Grande-Terre. Let the fish alone. We'll go wherever you like, he said. I'll have Tony come over and help me patch and trim my boat. We shall not need Beaudelet nor anyone. Are you afraid of the pirogue? Oh, no. Then I'll take you some night in the pirogue when the moon shines. Maybe your gulf spirit will whisper to you in which of these islands the treasures are hidden, direct you to the very spot, perhaps. And in a day we should be rich, she laughed. I'd give it all to you, the pirate gold and every bit of treasure we could dig up. I think you would know how to spend it. Pirate gold isn't a thing to be hoarded or utilized. It is something to squander and throw to the four winds for the fun of seeing the golden specks fly. We'd share it and scatter it together, he said. His face flushed. They all went together up to the quaint little Gothic church of Our Lady of Lourdes, gleaming all brown and yellow with paint in the sun's glare. Only Beaudelet remained behind, tinkering at his boat, and Mariquita walked away with her basket of shrimps, casting a look of childish ill-humor and reproach at Robert from the corner of her eye. 13. A feeling of oppression and drowsiness overcame Edna during the service. Her head began to ache, and the lights on the altar swayed before her eyes. Another time she might have made an effort to regain her composure, but her one thought was to quit the stifling atmosphere of church and reach the open air. She arose, climbing over Robert's feet with a muttered apology. Old Monsieur Farival, flurried, curious, stood up, but upon seeing that Robert had followed Mrs. Pontellier, he sank back into his seat. He whispered an anxious inquiry of the lady in black, who did not notice him or reply, but kept her eyes fastened upon the pages of her velvet prayer book. I felt giddy and almost overcome, Edna said, lifting her hands instinctively to her head and pushing her straw hat up from her forehead. I couldn't have stayed through the service. They were outside in the shadow of the church. Robert was full of solicitude. It was folly to have thought of going in the first place, let alone staying. Come over to Madame Antoine's. You can rest there. He took her arm and led her away, looking anxiously and continuously down into her face. How still it was, with only the voice of the sea whispering through the reeds that grew in the saltwater pools. The long line of little gray, weather-beaten houses nestled peacefully among the orange trees. It must always have been God's day on that low, drowsy island, Edna thought. They stopped leaning over a jagged fence made of sea drift to ask for water. A youth, a mild-faced Acadian, was drawing water from the cistern, which was nothing more than a rusty buoy with an opening at one side sunk in the ground. The water which the youth handed to them in a tin pail was not cold to taste, but it was cool to her heated face, and it greatly revived and refreshed her. Madame Antoine's cot was at the far end of the village. She welcomed them all with a native hospitality, as she would have opened her door to let the sunlight in. She was fat and walked heavily and clumsily across the floor. She could speak no English, but when Robert made her understand that the lady who accompanied him was ill and desired to rest, she was all eagerness to make Edna feel at home and to dispose of her comfortably. The whole place was immaculately clean, and the big four-posted bed, snow-white, invited one to repose. It stood in a small side room which looked out across a narrow grass plot toward the shed, where there was a disabled boat lying keel upward. Madame Antoine had not gone to Mass. Her son Tony had, but she supposed he would soon be back, and she invited Robert to be seated and wait for him. But he went and sat outside the door and smoked. Madame Antoine busied herself in the large front room preparing dinner. She was boiling mullets over a few red coals in the huge fireplace. Edna, left alone in the little side room, loosened her clothes, removing the greater part of them. She bathed her face, her neck, and arms in the basin that stood between the windows. She took off her shoes and stockings and stretched herself in the very center of the high white bed. How luxurious it felt to rest thus in a strange, quaint bed, with its sweet country odor of laurel lingering about the sheets and mattress. She stretched her strong limbs that ached a little. She ran her fingers through her loosened hair for a while. She looked at her round arms as she held them straight up and rubbed them one after the other, observing closely, as if it were something she saw for the first time, the fine, firm quality and texture of her flesh. She clasped her hands easily above her head, and it was thus she fell asleep. She slept lightly at first, half awake and drowsily attentive to the things about her. She could hear Madame Antoine's heavy, scraping tread as she walked back and forth on the sanded floor. Some chickens were clucking outside the windows, scratching for bits of gravel in the grass. Later she half heard the voices of Robert and Tony talking under the shed. She did not stir. Even her eyelids rested numb and heavily over her sleepy eyes. The voices went on, Tony's slow Acadian drawl, Robert's quick, soft, smooth French. She understood French imperfectly unless directly addressed, and the voices were only part of the other drowsy, muffled sounds lulling her senses. When Edna awoke, it was with the conviction that she had slept long and soundly. The voices were hushed under the shed. Madame Antoine's step was no longer to be heard in the adjoining room. Even the chickens had gone elsewhere to scratch and cluck. The mosquito bar was drawn over her. The old woman had come in while she slept and let down the bar. Edna arose quietly from the bed, and looking between the curtains of the window, she saw by the slanting rays of the sun that the afternoon was far advanced. Robert was out there under the shed, reclining in the shade against the sloping keel of the overturned boat. He was reading from a book. Tony was no longer with him. She wondered what had become of the rest of the party. She peeped out at him two or three times as she stood washing herself in the little basin between the windows. Madame Antoine had laid some coarse, clean towels upon a chair and had placed a box of poudre de riz within easy reach. Edna dabbed the powder upon her nose and cheeks as she looked at herself closely in the little distorted mirror which hung on the wall above the basin. Her eyes were bright and wide awake, and her face glowed. When she had completed her toilet, she walked into the adjoining room. She was very hungry. No one was there. But there was a cloth spread upon the table that stood against the wall, and a cover was laid for one, with a crusty brown loaf and a bottle of wine beside the plate. Edna bit a piece from the brown loaf, tearing it with her strong white teeth. She poured some of the wine into the glass and drank it down. Then she went softly out of doors, and plucking an orange from the low-hanging bough of a tree, threw it at Robert, who did not know she was awake and up. An illumination broke over his whole face when he saw her and joined her under the orange tree. "How many years have I slept?" she inquired. "The whole island seems changed. A new race of beings must have sprung up, leaving only you and me as past relics. How many ages ago did Madame Antoine and Tony die? And when did our people from Grand Island disappear from the earth?" He familiarly adjusted a ruffle upon her shoulder. "You have slept precisely 100 years. I was left here to guard your slumbers. And for 100 years I have been out under the shed reading a book. The only evil I couldn't prevent was to keep a broiled fowl from drying up." "If it has turned to stone, still will I eat it," said Edna, moving with him into the house. "But really, what has become of Monsieur Farival and the others?" "Gone hours ago. When they found that you were sleeping, they thought it best not to wake you. Anyway, I wouldn't have let them. What was I here for?"
"I wonder if Léonce will be uneasy," she speculated as she seated herself at the table.
"Of course not. He knows you are with me," Robert replied as he busied himself among sundry pans and covered dishes, which had been left standing on the hearth.
"Where are Madame Antoine and her son?" asked Edna.
"Gone to Vespers and to visit some friends, I believe. I am to take you back in Tony's boat whenever you are ready to go."
He stirred the smoldering ashes till the broiled fowl began to sizzle afresh. He served her with no mean repast, dripping the coffee anew and sharing it with her. Madame Antoine had cooked little less than the mullets, but while Edna slept, Robert had foraged the island. He was childishly gratified to discover her appetite and to see the relish with which she ate the food which he had procured for her. "Shall we go right away?" she asked after draining her glass and brushing together the crumbs of the crusty loaf.
"The sun isn't as low as it will be in 2 hours," he answered. The sun will be gone in 2 hours. Well, let it go. Who cares?
They waited a good while under the orange trees till Madame Antoine came back, panting, waddling, with 1,000 apologies to explain her absence. Tony did not dare to return. He was shy and would not willingly face any woman except his mother. It was very pleasant to stay there under the orange trees while the sun dipped lower and lower, turning the western sky to flaming copper and gold. The shadows lengthened and crept out like stealthy, grotesque monsters across the grass. Edna and Robert both sat upon the ground. That is, he lay upon the ground beside her, occasionally picking at the hem of her muslin gown. Madame Antoine seated her fat body, broad and squat, upon a bench beside the door. She had been talking all the afternoon and had wound herself up to the storytelling pitch. And what stories she told them! But twice in her life she had left the Chenier Caminada, and then for the briefest span. All her years she had squatted and waddled there upon the island, gathering legends of the Baratarians and the sea. The night came on, with the moon to lighten it. Edna could hear the whispering voices of dead men and the click of muffled gold. When she and Robert stepped into Tony's boat, with the red lateen sail, misty spirit forms were prowling in the shadows and among the weeds, and upon the water were phantom ships, speeding to cover. 14. The youngest boy, Etienne, had been very naughty, Madame Ratignolle said, as she delivered him into the hands of his mother. He had been unwilling to go to bed and had made a scene, whereupon she had taken charge of him and pacified him as well as she could. Raoul had been in bed and asleep for 2 hours. The youngster was in his long white nightgown that kept tripping him up as Madame Ratignolle led him along by the hand. With the other chubby fist he rubbed his eyes, which were heavy with sleep and ill-humor. Edna took him in her arms and, seating herself in the rocker, began to coddle and caress him, calling him all manner of tender names, soothing him to sleep. It was not more than 9 o'clock. No one had yet gone to bed but the children. Léonce had been very uneasy at first, Madame Ratignolle said, and had wanted to start at once for the Chenier. But Monsieur Farival had assured him that his wife was only overcome with sleep and fatigue, that Tony would bring her safely back later in the day. And he had thus been dissuaded from crossing the bay. He had gone over to Klein's, looking up some cotton broker whom he wished to see in regard to securities, exchanges, stocks, bonds, or something of the sort, Madame Ratignolle did not remember what. He said he would not remain away late. She herself was suffering from heat and oppression, she said. She carried a bottle of salts and a large fan. She would not consent to remain with Edna, for Monsieur Ratignolle was alone, and he detested above all things to be left alone. When Etienne had fallen asleep, Edna bore him into the back room, and Robert went and lifted the mosquito bar that she might lay the child comfortably in his bed. The quadroon had vanished. When they emerged from the cottage, Robert bade Edna good night. "Do you know we have been together the whole livelong day, Robert, since early this morning?" she said at parting. "All but the 100 years when you were sleeping. Good night." He pressed her hand and went away in the direction of the beach. He did not join any of the others, but walked alone toward the gulf. Edna stayed outside, awaiting her husband's return. She had no desire to sleep or to retire, nor did she feel like going over to sit with the Ratignolles, or to join Madame Lebrun and a group whose animated voices reached her as they sat in conversation before the house. She let her mind wander back over her stay at Grand Isle, and she tried to discover wherein this summer had been different from any and every other summer of her life. She could only realize that she herself, her present self, was in some way different from the other self. That she was seeing with different eyes and making the acquaintance of new conditions in herself that colored and changed her environment, she did not yet suspect. She wondered why Robert had gone away and left her. It did not occur to her to think he might have grown tired of being with her the livelong day. She was not tired, and she felt that he was not. She regretted that he had gone. It was so much more natural to have him stay when he was not absolutely required to leave her. As Edna waited for her husband, she sang low a little song that Robert had sung as they crossed the bay. It began with, "Ah, si tu savais," and every verse ended with, "Si tu savais." Robert's voice was not pretentious. It was musical and true. The voice, the notes, the whole refrain haunted her memory. 15.
When Edna entered the dining room one evening a little late, as was her habit, an unusually animated conversation seemed to be going on. Several persons were talking at once, and Victor's voice was predominating, even over that of his mother. Edna had returned late from her bath, had dressed in some haste, and her face was flushed. Her head, set off by her dainty white gown, suggested a rich, rare blossom. She took her seat at the table between old Monsieur Farival and Madame Ratignolle. As she seated herself and was about to begin to eat her soup, which had been served when she entered the room, several persons informed her simultaneously that Robert was going to Mexico. She laid her spoon down and looked about her bewildered. He had been with her, reading to her all the morning, and had never even mentioned such a place as Mexico. She had not seen him during the afternoon. She had heard someone say he was at the house upstairs with his mother. This she had thought nothing of, though she was surprised when he did not join her later in the afternoon when she went down to the beach. She looked across at him where he sat beside Madame Lebrun, who presided. Edna's face was a blank picture of bewilderment, which she never thought of disguising. He lifted his eyebrows with the pretext of a smile as he returned her glance. He looked embarrassed and uneasy. "When is he going?" she asked of everybody in general, as if Robert were not there to answer for himself. "Tonight." "This very evening." "Did you ever?" "What possesses him?" were some of the replies she gathered, uttered simultaneously in French and English. "Impossible!" she exclaimed. "How can a person start off from Grand Isle to Mexico at a moment's notice, as if he were going over to Klein's or to the wharf or down to the beach?"
"I said all along I was going to Mexico. I've been saying so for years," cried Robert in an excited and irritable tone, with the air of a man defending himself against a swarm of stinging insects. Madame Lebrun knocked on the table with her knife handle.
"Please let Robert explain why he is going and why he is going tonight," she called out. "Really, this table is getting to be more and more like bedlam every day with everybody talking at once. Sometimes, I hope God will forgive me, but positively sometimes I wish Victor would lose the power of speech."
Victor laughed sardonically as he thanked his mother for her holy wish, of which he failed to see the benefit to anybody except that it might afford her a more ample opportunity and license to talk herself. Monsieur Farival thought that Victor should have been taken out in mid-ocean in his earliest youth and drowned. Victor thought there would be more logic in thus disposing of old people with an established claim for making themselves universally obnoxious. Madame Lebrun grew a trifle hysterical. Robert called his brother some sharp, hard names.
"There's nothing much to explain, Mother," he said, though he explained nevertheless, looking chiefly at Edna, that he could only meet the gentleman whom he intended to join at Vera Cruz by taking such and such a steamer which left New Orleans on such a day, that Beaudelet was going out with his lugger load of vegetables that night, which gave him an opportunity of reaching the city and making his vessel in time.
"But when did you make up your mind to all this?" demanded Monsieur Farival.
"This afternoon," returned Robert with a shade of annoyance.
"At what time this afternoon?"
persisted the old gentleman with nagging determination, as if he were cross-questioning a criminal in a court of justice.
"At 4 o'clock this afternoon, Monsieur Farival," Robert replied in a high voice with a lofty air, which reminded Edna of some gentleman on the stage. She had forced herself to eat most of her soup, and now she was picking the flaky bits of a court bouillon with her fork. The lovers were profiting by the general conversation on Mexico to speak in whispers of matters which they rightly considered were interesting to no one but themselves. The lady in black had once received a pair of prayer beads of curious workmanship from Mexico, with very special indulgence attached to them, but she had never been able to ascertain whether the indulgence extended outside the Mexican border. Father Fauchel of the cathedral had attempted to explain it, but he had not done so to her satisfaction. And she begged that Robert would interest himself and discover, if possible, whether she was entitled to the indulgence accompanying the remarkably curious Mexican prayer beads. Madame Ratignolle hoped that Robert would exercise extreme caution in dealing with the Mexicans, who she considered were a treacherous people, unscrupulous and revengeful. She trusted she did them no injustice in thus condemning them as a race. She had known personally but one Mexican who made and sold excellent tamales, and whom she would have trusted implicitly, so soft-spoken was he. One day he was arrested for stabbing his wife. She never knew whether he had been hanged or not.
Victor had grown hilarious and was attempting to tell an anecdote about a Mexican girl who served chocolate one winter in a restaurant in Dauphine Street. No one would listen to him but old Monsieur Farival, who went into convulsions over the droll story. Edna wondered if they had all gone mad to be talking and clamoring at that rate. She herself could think of nothing to say about Mexico or the Mexicans. "At what time do you leave?" she asked Robert.
"At 10," he told her.
"Baudelaire wants to wait for the moon."
"Are you all ready to go?"
"Quite ready. I shall only take a handbag and shall pack my trunk in the city." He turned to answer some question put to him by his mother, and Edna, having finished her black coffee, left the table. She went directly to her room. The little cottage was close and stuffy after leaving the outer air, but she did not mind. There appeared to be 100 different things demanding her attention indoors. She began to set the toilet stand to rights, grumbling at the negligence of the quadroon, who was in the adjoining room putting the children to bed. She gathered together stray garments that were hanging on the backs of chairs, and put each where it belonged in closet or bureau drawer. She changed her gown for a more comfortable and commodious wrapper. She rearranged her hair, combing and brushing it with unusual energy. Then she went in and assisted the quadroon in getting the boys to bed. They were very playful and inclined to talk, to do anything but lie quiet and go to sleep. Edna sent the quadroon away to her supper and told her she need not return. Then she sat and told the children a story. Instead of soothing, it excited them and added to their wakefulness. She left them in heated argument, speculating about the conclusion of the tale which their mother promised to finish the following night. The little black girl came in to say that Madame Lebrun would like to have Mrs. Pontellier go and sit with them over at the house till Mr. Robert went away. Edna returned answer that she had already undressed, that she did not feel quite well, but perhaps she would go over to the house later. She started to dress again and got as far advanced as to remove her peignoir. But changing her mind once more, she resumed the peignoir and went outside and sat down before her door. She was overheated and irritable and fanned herself energetically for a while. Madame Ratignolle came down to discover what was the matter. "All that noise and confusion at the table must have upset me," replied Edna. "And moreover, I hate shocks and surprises. The idea of Robert starting off in such a ridiculously sudden and dramatic way, as if it were a matter of life and death, never saying a word about it all morning when he was with me."
"Yes," agreed Madame Ratignolle. "I think it was showing us all, you especially, very little consideration. It wouldn't have surprised me in any of the others. Those Lebruns are all given to heroics. But I must say, I should never have expected such a thing from Robert. Are you not coming down? Come on, dear, it doesn't look friendly."
"No," said Edna, a little sullenly. "I can't go to the trouble of dressing again. I don't feel like it."
"You needn't dress. You look all right. Fasten a belt around your waist. Just look at me."
"No," persisted Edna. "But you go on. Madame Lebrun might be offended if we both stayed away."
Madame Ratignolle kissed Edna goodnight and went away, being, in truth, rather desirous of joining in the general and animated conversation which was still in progress concerning Mexico and the Mexicans. Somewhat later, Robert came up, carrying his handbag.
"Aren't you feeling well?" he asked.
"Oh, well enough.
Are you going right away?"
He lit a match and looked at his watch.
"In 20 minutes, he said.
The sudden and brief flare of the match emphasized the darkness for a while. He sat down upon a stool which the children had left out on the porch.
"Get a chair," said Edna.
"This will do," he replied. He put on his soft hat and nervously took it off again, and, wiping his face with his handkerchief, complained of the heat.
"Take the fan," Edna said, offering it to him.
"Oh, no, thank you. It does no good. You have to stop fanning sometime and feel all the more uncomfortable afterward."
"That's one of the ridiculous things which men always say. I have never known one to speak otherwise of fanning.
How long will you be gone?"
"Forever, perhaps. I don't know. It depends upon a good many things."
"Well, in case it shouldn't be forever, how long will it be?"
"I don't know."
"This seems to me perfectly preposterous and uncalled for. I don't like it.
I don't understand your motive for silence and mystery. Never saying a word to me about it this morning?
He remained silent, not offering to defend himself. He only said, after a moment,
Don't part from me in ill humor. I never knew you to be out of patience with me before.
I don't want to part in any ill humor, she said. But can't you understand? I've grown used to seeing you, to having you with me all the time, and your action seems unfriendly, even unkind. You don't even offer an excuse for it. Why, I was planning to be together, thinking of how pleasant it would be to see you in the city next winter.
So was I, he blurted. Perhaps that's...
He stood up suddenly and held out his hand.
Goodbye, my dear Mrs. Pontellier.
Goodbye.
You won't, I hope you won't completely forget me.
She clung to his hand, striving to detain him.
Write to me when you get there, won't you, Robert? She entreated.
I will, thank you.
Goodbye. How unlike Robert! The merest acquaintance would have said something more emphatic than, I will, thank you, goodbye, to such a request. He had evidently already taken leave of the people over at the house, for he descended the steps and went to join Beaudelet, who was out there with an oar across his shoulder waiting for Robert. They walked away in the darkness. She could only hear Beaudelet's voice. Robert had apparently not even spoken a word of greeting to his companion. Edna bit her handkerchief convulsively, striving to hold back and to hide, even from herself, as she would have hidden from another, the emotion which was troubling, tearing her. Her eyes were brimming with tears. For the first time she recognized anew the symptoms of infatuation which she had felt incipiently as a child, as a girl in her earliest teens, and later as a young woman. The recognition did not lessen the reality, the poignancy of the revelation by any suggestion or promise of instability. The past was nothing to her, offered no lesson which she was willing to heed. The future was a mystery which she never attempted to penetrate. The present alone was significant, was hers, to torture her as it was doing then with the biting which her impassioned, newly awakened being demanded.
16.
"Do you miss your friend greatly?" asked Mademoiselle Rise one morning as she came creeping up behind Edna, who had just left her cottage on her way to the beach. She spent much of her time in the water, since she had acquired finally the art of swimming. As their stay at Grand Isle drew near its close, she felt that she could not give too much time to a diversion which afforded her the only pleasurable moments that she knew. When Mademoiselle Rise came and touched her upon the shoulder and spoke to her, the woman seemed to echo the thought which was ever in Edna's mind, or better, the feeling which constantly possessed her. Robert's going had some way taken the brightness, the color, the meaning out of everything. The conditions of her life were in no way changed, but her whole existence was dulled, like a faded garment which seems to be no longer worth wearing. She sought him everywhere, in others whom she induced to talk about him. She went up in the mornings to Madame Lebrun's room, braving the clatter of the old sewing machine. She sat there and chatted at intervals as Robert had done. She gazed around the room at the pictures and photographs hanging upon the wall and discovered in some corner an old family album, which she examined with the keenest interest, appealing to Madame Lebrun for enlightenment concerning the many figures and faces which she discovered between its pages. There was a picture of Madame Lebrun with Robert as a baby, seated in her lap, a round-faced infant with a fist in his mouth. The eyes alone in the baby suggested the man. And that was he also in kilts at the age of 5, wearing long curls and holding a whip in his hand. It made Edna laugh, and she laughed too at the portrait in his first long trousers. While another interested her, taken when he left for college, looking thin, long-faced, with eyes full of fire, ambition, and great intentions. But there was no recent picture, none which suggested the Robert who had gone away 5 days ago, leaving a void and wilderness behind him. Oh, Robert stopped having his pictures taken when he had to pay for them himself. He found wiser use for his money, he says, explained Madame Lebrun. She had a letter from him, written before he left New Orleans. Edna wished to see the letter, and Madame Lebrun told her to look for it either on the table or the dresser, or perhaps it was on the mantelpiece. The letter was on the bookshelf.
It possessed the greatest interest and attraction for Edna, the envelope, its size and shape, the postmark, the handwriting. She examined every detail of the outside before opening it. There were only a few lines setting forth that he would leave the city that afternoon, that he had packed his trunk in good shape, that he was well, and sent her his love and begged to be affectionately remembered to all. There was no special message to Edna except a postscript saying that if Mrs. Pontellier desired to finish the book which he had been reading to her, his mother would find it in his room, among other books there on the table. Edna experienced a pang of jealousy because he had written to his mother rather than to her. Everyone seemed to take for granted that she missed him. Even her husband, when he came down the Saturday following Robert's departure, expressed regret that he had gone.
"How do you get on without him, Edna?" he asked.
"It's very dull without him," she admitted. Mr. Pontellier had seen Robert in the city, and Edna asked him a dozen questions or more. Where had they met? On Carondelet Street in the morning. They had gone in and had a drink and a cigar together. What had they talked about? Chiefly about his prospects in Mexico, which Mr. Pontellier thought were promising. How did he look? How did he seem, grave or gay or how? Quite cheerful and wholly taken up with the idea of his trip, which Mr. Pontellier found altogether natural in a young fellow about to seek fortune and adventure in a strange, queer country. Edna tapped her foot impatiently and wondered why the children persisted in playing in the sun when they might be under the trees. She went down and led them out of the sun, scolding the quadroon for not being more attentive. It did not strike her as in the least grotesque that she should be making of Robert the object of conversation and leading her husband to speak of him. The sentiment which she entertained for Robert in no way resembled that which she felt for her husband, or had ever felt or ever expected to feel. She had all her life long been accustomed to harbor thoughts and emotions which never voiced themselves. They had never taken the form of struggles. They belonged to her and were her own, and she entertained the conviction that she had a right to them and that they concerned no one but herself. Edna had once told Madame Ratignolle that she would never sacrifice herself for her children, or for anyone. Then had followed a rather heated argument. The two women did not appear to understand each other or to be talking the same language. Edna tried to appease her friend, to explain. "I would give up the unessential. I would give my money. I would give my life for my children. But I wouldn't give myself. I can't make it more clear. It's only something which I am beginning to comprehend, which is revealing itself to me." "I don't know what you would call the essential, or what you mean by the unessential," said Madame Ratignolle cheerfully. "But a woman who would give her life for her children could do no more than that. Your Bible tells you so. I'm sure I couldn't do more than that."
"Oh, yes, you could," laughed Edna.
She was not surprised at Mademoiselle Rice's question the morning that lady, following her to the beach, tapped her on the shoulder and asked if she did not greatly miss her young friend. "Oh, good morning, Mademoiselle. Is it you? Why, of course I miss Robert. Are you going down to bathe?"
"Why should I go down to bathe at the very end of the season when I haven't been in the surf all summer?" replied the woman disagreeably.
"I beg your pardon," offered Edna in some embarrassment, for she should have remembered that Mademoiselle Rice's avoidance of the water had furnished a theme for much pleasantry. Some among them thought it was on account of her false hair, or the dread of getting the violets wet, while others attributed it to the natural aversion for water sometimes believed to accompany the artistic temperament. Mademoiselle offered Edna some chocolates in a paper bag, which she took from her pocket, by way of showing that she bore no ill feeling. She habitually ate chocolates for their sustaining quality. They contained much nutriment in small compass, she said. They saved her from starvation, as Madame Lebrun's table was utterly impossible, and no one, save so impertinent a woman as Madame Lebrun, could think of offering such food to people and requiring them to pay for it. "She must feel very lonely without her son," said Edna, desiring to change the subject. "Her favorite son, too. It must have been quite hard to let him go." Mademoiselle laughed maliciously.
"Her favorite son? Oh, dear! Who could have been imposing such a tale upon you? Aileen de Rebon lives for Victor, and for Victor alone. She has spoiled him into the worthless creature he is. She worships him and the ground he walks on.
Robert is very well in a way to give up all the money he can earn to the family and keep the barest pittance for himself. Favorite son, indeed. I miss the poor fellow myself, my dear. I liked to see him and to hear him about the place. The only Lebrun who is worth a pinch of salt. He comes to see me often in the city. I like to play with him. That Victor. Hanging would be too good for him. It's a wonder Robert hasn't beaten him to death long ago.
I thought he had great patience with his brother, offered Edna, glad to be talking about Robert, no matter what was said.
Oh, he thrashed him well enough a year or two ago, said Mademoiselle. It was about a Spanish girl whom Victor considered that he had some sort of claim upon. He met Robert one day talking to the girl, or walking with her, or bathing with her, or carrying her basket, I don't remember what. And he became so insulting and abusive that Robert gave him a thrashing on the spot that has kept him comparatively in order for a good while. It's about time he was getting another.
Was her name Mariquita? Asked Edna.
Mariquita. Yes, that was it. Mariquita. I had forgotten. Oh, she's a sly one, and a bad one, that Mariquita.
Edna looked down at Mademoiselle Rise and wondered how she could have listened to her venom so long. For some reason she felt depressed, almost unhappy.
She had not intended to go into the water, but she donned her bathing suit and left Mademoiselle alone, seated under the shade of the children's tent. The water was growing cooler as the season advanced. Edna plunged and swam about with an abandon that thrilled and invigorated her. She remained a long time in the water, half hoping that Mademoiselle Rise would not wait for her. But Mademoiselle waited. She was very amiable during the walk back and raved much over Edna's appearance in her bathing suit. She talked about music. She hoped that Edna would go to see her in the city, and wrote her address with the stub of a pencil on a piece of card which she found in her pocket.
"When do you leave?" asked Edna.
"Next Monday. And you?"
"The following week," answered Edna, adding, "It has been a pleasant summer, hasn't it, Mademoiselle?"
"Well," agreed Mademoiselle Rise with a shrug. "Rather pleasant if it hadn't been for the mosquitoes and the Farival twins."
17. The Pontelliers possessed a very charming home on Esplanade Street in New Orleans. It was a large double cottage with a broad front veranda, whose round fluted columns supported the sloping roof. The house was painted a dazzling white. The outside shutters or jalousies were green. In the yard, which was kept scrupulously neat, were flowers and plants of every description which flourishes in South Louisiana. Within doors, the appointments were perfect after the conventional type. The softest carpets and rugs covered the floors, rich and tasteful draperies hung at doors and windows. There were paintings selected with judgment and discrimination upon the walls. The cut glass, the silver, the heavy damask which daily appeared upon the table were the envy of many women, whose husbands were less generous than Mr. Pontellier. Mr. Pontellier was very fond of walking about his house, examining its various appointments and details, to see that nothing was amiss. He greatly valued his possessions, chiefly because they were his, and derived genuine pleasure from contemplating a painting, a statuette, a rare lace curtain, no matter what, after he had bought it and placed it among his household goods. On Tuesday afternoons, Tuesday being Mrs. Pontellier's reception day, there was a constant stream of callers, women who came in carriages or in the streetcars, or walked when the air was soft and distance permitted. A light-colored mulatto boy, in dress coat and bearing a diminutive silver tray for the reception of cards, admitted them. A maid in white fluted cap offered the callers liqueur, coffee, or chocolate, as they might desire. Mrs. Pontellier, attired in a handsome reception gown, remained in the drawing-room the entire afternoon receiving her visitors. Men sometimes called in the evening with their wives. This had been the program which Mrs. Pontellier had religiously followed since her marriage 6 years before. Certain evenings during the week she and her husband attended the opera or sometimes the play. Mr. Pontellier left his home in the mornings between 9 and 10 o'clock and rarely returned before 6:30 or 7 in the evening, dinner being served at 7:30. He and his wife seated themselves at table one Tuesday evening, a few weeks after their return from Grand Isle. They were alone together. The boys were being put to bed. The patter of their bare, escaping feet could be heard occasionally, as well as the pursuing voice of the quadroon, lifted in mild protest and entreaty.
Mrs. Pontellier did not wear her usual Tuesday reception gown. She was in ordinary house dress. Mr. Pontellier, who was observant about such things, noticed it as he served the soup and handed it to the boy in waiting.
"Tired out, Edna? Whom did you have? Many callers?" he asked.
He tasted his soup and began to season it with pepper, salt, vinegar, mustard, everything within reach.
"There were a good many," replied Edna, who was eating her soup with evident satisfaction. "I found their cards when I got home. I was out."
"Out!" exclaimed her husband, with something like genuine consternation in his voice as he laid down the vinegar cruet and looked at her through his glasses.
"Why, what could have taken you out on Tuesday? What did you have to do?"
"Nothing. I simply felt like going out, and I went out."
"Well, I hope you left some suitable excuse," said her husband, somewhat appeased as he added a dash of cayenne pepper to the soup.
"No, I left no excuse. I told Joe to say I was out, that was all."
"Why, my dear, I should think you'd understand by this time that people don't do such things. We've got to observe les convenances if we ever expect to get on and keep up with the procession. If you felt that you had to leave home this afternoon, you should have left some suitable explanation for your absence." "This soup is really impossible. It's strange that woman hasn't learned yet to make a decent soup. Any free lunch stand in town serves a better one. Was Mrs. Belthrop here?"
"Bring the tray with the cards, Joe. I don't remember who was here."
The boy retired and returned after a moment, bringing the tiny silver tray, which was covered with ladies' visiting cards. He handed it to Mrs. Pontellier.
"Give it to Mr. Pontellier," she said.
Joe offered the tray to Mr. Pontellier and removed the soup. Mr. Pontellier scanned the names of his wife's callers, reading some of them aloud, with comments as he read.
"The Mrs. Delacidas. I worked a big deal in futures for their father this morning. Nice girls. It's time they were getting married. Mrs. Belthrop. I tell you what it is, Edna, you can't afford to snub Mrs. Belthrop. Why, Belthrop could buy and sell us 10 times over. His business is worth a good round sum to me. You better write her a note. Mrs. James Highcamp. Phew, the less you have to do with Mrs. Highcamp, the better. Madame LaForce, say. Came all the way from Carrollton, too, poor old soul. Miss Wiggs, Mrs. Zellner Bolton's..."
He pushed the cards aside.
"Mercy!" exclaimed Edna, who had been fuming. "Why are you taking the thing so seriously and making such a fuss over it?" "I'm not making any fuss over it, but it's just such seeming trifles that we've got to take seriously. Such things count."
The fish was scorched. Mr. Pontellier would not touch it. Edna said she did not mind a little scorched taste. The roast was in some way not to his fancy, and he did not like the manner in which the vegetables were served.
"It seems to me," he said, "we spend money enough in this house to procure at least one meal a day which a man could eat and retain his self-respect."
"You used to think the cook was a treasure," returned Edna indifferently.
"Perhaps she was when she first came, but cooks are only human. They need looking after, like any other class of persons that you employ. Suppose I didn't look after the clerks in my office, just let them run things their own way. They'd soon make a nice mess of me and my business."
"Where are you going?"
asked Edna, seeing that her husband arose from the table without having eaten a morsel, except a taste of the highly seasoned soup.
"I'm going to get my dinner at the club. Good night."
He went into the hall, took his hat and stick from the stand, and left the house. She was somewhat familiar with such scenes. They had often made her very unhappy. On a few previous occasions, she had been completely deprived of any desire to finish her dinner. Sometimes she had gone into the kitchen to administer a tardy rebuke to the cook. Once she went to her room and studied the cookbook during an entire evening, finally writing out a menu for the week, which left her harassed with a feeling that, after all, she had accomplished no good that was worth the name. But that evening Edna finished her dinner alone with forced deliberation. Her face was flushed and her eyes flamed with some inward fire that lighted them. After finishing her dinner, she went to her room, having instructed the boy to tell any other callers that she was indisposed. It was a large, beautiful room, rich and picturesque in the soft, dim light which the maid had turned low.
She went and stood at an open window and looked out upon the deep tangle of the garden below. All the mystery and witchery of the night seemed to have gathered there amid the perfumes and the dusky and tortuous outlines of flowers and foliage. She was seeking herself and finding herself in just such sweet half-darkness which met her moods. But the voices were not soothing that came to her from the darkness and the sky above and the stars. They jeered and sounded mournful notes without promise, devoid even of hope. She turned back into the room and began to walk to and fro down its whole length without stopping, without resting. She carried in her hands a thin handkerchief, which she tore into ribbons, rolled into a ball, and flung from her. Once she stopped, and taking off her wedding ring, flung it upon the carpet. When she saw it lying there, she stamped her heel upon it, striving to crush it. But her small boot heel did not make an indenture, not a mark upon the little glittering circlet. In a sweeping passion, she seized a glass vase from the table and flung it upon the tiles of the hearth. She wanted to destroy something. The crash and clatter were what she wanted to hear. A maid, alarmed at the din of breaking glass, entered the room to discover what was the matter. "A vase fell upon the hearth," said Edna. "Never mind, leave it till morning." "Oh, you might get some glass in your feet, ma'am," insisted the young woman, picking up bits of the broken vase that were scattered upon the carpet. "And here's your ring, ma'am, under the chair." Edna held out her hand and, taking the ring, slipped it upon her finger. 18. The following morning, Mr. Pontellier, upon leaving for his office, asked Edna if she would not meet him in town in order to look at some new fixtures for the library. "I hardly think we need new fixtures, Léonce. Don't let us get anything new. You are too extravagant. I don't believe you ever think of saving or putting by." "The way to become rich is to make money, my dear Edna, not to save it," he said. He regretted that she did not feel inclined to go with him and select new fixtures. He kissed her goodbye and told her she was not looking well and must take care of herself. She was unusually pale and very quiet. She stood on the front veranda as he quitted the house and absently picked a few sprays of jessamine that grew upon a trellis nearby. She inhaled the odor of the blossoms and thrust them into the bosom of her white morning gown. The boys were dragging along the banquette a small express wagon, which they had filled with blocks and sticks. The quadroon was following them with little quick steps, having assumed a fictitious animation and alacrity for the occasion. A fruit vendor was crying his wares in the street. Edna looked straight before her with a self-absorbed expression upon her face. She felt no interest in anything about her. The street, the children, the fruit vendor, the flowers growing there under her eyes, were all part and parcel of an alien world which had suddenly become antagonistic. She went back into the house. She had thought of speaking to the cook concerning her blunders of the previous night. But Mr. Pontellier had saved her that disagreeable mission, for which she was so poorly fitted. Mr. Pontellier's arguments were usually convincing with those whom he employed. He left home feeling quite sure that he and Edna would sit down that evening, and possibly a few subsequent evenings, to a dinner deserving of the name. Edna spent an hour or two in looking over some of her old sketches. She could see their shortcomings and defects, which were glaring in her eyes. She tried to work a little, but she found she was not in the humor. Finally, she gathered together a few of the sketches, those which she considered the least discreditable, and she carried them with her when, a little later, she dressed and left the house. She looked handsome and distinguished in her street gown. The tan of the seashore had left her face, and her forehead was smooth, white, and polished beneath her heavy yellow-brown hair. There were a few freckles on her face, and a small dark mole near the upper lip, and one on the temple, half hidden in her hair. As Edna walked along the street, she was thinking of Robert. She was still under the spell of her infatuation. She had tried to forget him, realizing the inutility of remembering. But the thought of him was like an obsession ever pressing itself upon her. It was not that she dwelt upon details of their acquaintance, or recalled in any special or peculiar way his personality. It was his being, his existence, which dominated her thought, fading sometimes as if it would melt into the mist of the forgotten, reviving again with an intensity which filled her with an incomprehensible longing. Edna was on her way to Madame Ratignolle's. Their intimacy, begun at Grand Isle, had not declined,
and they had seen each other with some frequency since their return to the city. The Ratignolles lived at no great distance from Edna's home, on the corner of a side street, where Monsieur Ratignolle owned and conducted a drugstore which enjoyed a steady and prosperous trade. His father had been in the business before him, and Monsieur Ratignolle stood well in the community and bore an enviable reputation for integrity and clear-headedness. His family lived in commodious apartments over the store, having an entrance on the side with the porte cochère. There was something which Edna thought very French, very foreign about their whole manner of living. In the large and pleasant salon which extended across the width of the house, the Ratignolles entertained their friends once a fortnight with a soirée musicale, sometimes diversified by card-playing. There was a friend who played upon the cello. One brought his flute and another his violin, while there were some who sang and a number who performed upon the piano with various degrees of taste and agility. The Ratignolles' soirées musicales were widely known, and it was considered a privilege to be invited to them. Edna found her friend engaged in assorting the clothes which had returned that morning from the laundry. She at once abandoned her occupation upon seeing Edna, who had been ushered without ceremony into her presence. "Cité can do it as well as I. It is really her business," she explained to Edna, who apologized for interrupting her. As she summoned a young black woman, whom she instructed in French to be very careful in checking off the list which she handed her, she told her to notice particularly if a fine linen handkerchief of Monsieur Ratignolle's, which was missing last week, had been returned, and to be sure to set to one side such pieces as required mending and darning. Then, placing an arm around Edna's waist, she led her to the front of the house, to the salon, where it was cool and sweet with the odor of great roses that stood upon the hearth in jars. Madame Ratignolle looked more beautiful than ever there at home, in a negligee which left her arms almost wholly bare and exposed the rich, melting curves of her white throat. "Perhaps I shall be able to paint your picture some day," said Edna with a smile when they were seated. She produced the roll of sketches and started to unfold them. "I believe I ought to work again. I feel as if I wanted to be doing something. What do you think of them? Do you think it worthwhile to take it up again and study some more? I might study for a while with Laidpore." She knew that Madame Ratignolle's opinion in such a matter would be next to valueless, that she herself had not alone decided, but determined. But she sought the words of praise and encouragement that would help her to put her heart into her venture. "Your talent is immense, dear." "Nonsense," protested Edna, well pleased. "Immense, I tell you," persisted Madame Ratignolle, surveying the sketches one by one, at close range, then holding them at arm's length, narrowing her eyes and dropping her head on one side. "Surely this Bavarian peasant is worthy of framing. And this basket of apples, never have I seen anything more lifelike. One might be almost tempted to reach out a hand and take one." Edna could not control a feeling which bordered upon complacency at her friend's praise, even realizing, as she did, its true worth. She retained a few of the sketches and gave all the rest to Madame Ratignolle, who appreciated the gift far beyond its value and proudly exhibited the pictures to her husband when he came up from the store a little later for his midday dinner. Mr. Ratignolle was one of those men who are called the salt of the earth. His cheerfulness was unbounded, and it was matched by his goodness of heart, his broad charity, and common sense. He and his wife spoke English with an accent which was only discernible through its un-English emphasis and a certain carefulness and deliberation. Edna's husband spoke English with no accent whatever. The Ratignolles understood each other perfectly. If ever the fusion of two human beings into one has been accomplished on this sphere, it was surely in their union. As Edna seated herself at table with them, she thought, "Better a dinner of herbs," though it did not take her long to discover that was no dinner of herbs, but a delicious repast, simple, choice, and in every way satisfying. Monsieur Ratignolle was delighted to see her, though he found her looking not so well as at Grand Isle, and he advised a tonic. He talked a good deal on various topics, a little politics, some city news, and neighborhood gossip. He spoke with an animation and earnestness that gave an exaggerated importance to every syllable he uttered. His wife was keenly interested in everything he said, laying down her fork the better to listen, chiming in, taking the words out of his mouth. Edna felt depressed rather than soothed after leaving them. The little glimpse of domestic harmony which had been offered her gave her no regret, no longing. It was not a condition of life which fitted her,
and she could see in it but an appalling and hopeless ennui. She was moved by a kind of commiseration for Madame Ratignolle, a pity for that colorless existence which never uplifted its possessor beyond the recognition of blind contentment, in which no moment of anguish ever visited her soul, in which she would never have the taste of life's delirium. Edna vaguely wondered what she meant by life's delirium. It had crossed her thought like some unsought, extraneous impression. 19. Edna could not help but think that it was very foolish, very childish, to have stamped upon her wedding ring and smashed the crystal vase upon the tiles. She was visited by no more outbursts, moving her to such futile expedients. She began to do as she liked and to feel as she liked. She completely abandoned her Tuesdays at home, and did not return the visits of those who had called upon her. She made no ineffectual efforts to conduct her household en bonne ménagère, going and coming as it suited her fancy, and so far as she was able, lending herself to any passing caprice. Mr. Pontellier had been a rather courteous husband so long as he met a certain tacit submissiveness in his wife. But her new and unexpected line of conduct completely bewildered him. It shocked him. Then her absolute disregard for her duties as a wife angered him. When Mr. Pontellier became rude, Edna grew insolent. She had resolved never to take another step backward. It seems to me the utmost folly for a woman at the head of a household and the mother of children to spend in an atelier days which would be better employed contriving for the comfort of her family. I feel like painting, answered Edna. Perhaps I shan't always feel like it. Then, in God's name, paint, but don't let the family go to the devil. There's Madame Ratignolle. Because she keeps up her music, she doesn't let everything else go to chaos. And she's more of a musician than you are a painter. She isn't a musician, and I'm not a painter. It isn't on account of painting that I let things go. On account of what, then? Oh, I don't know. Let me alone. You bother me. It sometimes entered Mr. Pontellier's mind to wonder if his wife were not growing a little unbalanced mentally. He could see plainly that she was not herself. That is, he could not see that she was becoming herself and daily casting aside that fictitious self which we assume like a garment with which to appear before the world. Her husband let her alone, as she requested, and went away to his office. Edna went up to her atelier, a bright room in the top of the house. She was working with great energy and interest, without accomplishing anything, however, which satisfied her even in the smallest degree. For a time she had the whole household enrolled in the service of art. The boys had posed for her. They thought it amusing at first, but the occupation soon lost its attractiveness when they discovered that it was not a game arranged especially for their entertainment. The quadroon sat for hours before Edna's palette, patient as a savage, while the housemaid took charge of the children, and the drawing-room went undusted. But the housemaid, too, served her term as model when Edna perceived that the young woman's back and shoulders were molded on classic lines, and that her hair, loosened from its confining cap, became an inspiration. While Edna worked, she sometimes sang low the little air, Ah, si tu savais. It moved her with recollections. She could hear again the ripple of the water, the flapping sail. She could see the glint of the moon upon the bay, and could feel the soft beating of the hot south wind. A subtle current of desire passed through her body, weakening her hold upon the brushes and making her eyes burn. There were days when she was very happy without knowing why. She was happy to be alive and breathing, when her whole being seemed to be one with the sunlight, the color, the odors, the luxuriant warmth of some perfect southern day. She liked then to wander alone into the strange and unfamiliar places. She discovered many a sunny, sleepy corner, fashioned to dream in. And she found it good to dream and to be alone and unmolested. There were days when she was unhappy, she did not know why, when it did not seem worthwhile to be glad or sorry, to be alive or dead, when life appeared to her like a grotesque pandemonium and humanity like worms struggling blindly toward inevitable annihilation. She could not work on such a day, nor weave fancies to stir her pulses and warm her blood. 20. It was during such a mood that Edna hunted up Mademoiselle Reisz. She had not forgotten the rather disagreeable impression left upon her by their last interview. but she nevertheless felt a desire to see her, above all, to listen while she played upon the piano. Quite early in the afternoon, she started upon her quest for the pianist. Unfortunately, she had mislaid or lost Mademoiselle Rise's card, and looking up her address in the city directory, she found that the woman lived on Bienville Street, some distance away. The directory which fell into her hands was a year or more old, however, and upon reaching the number indicated, Edna discovered that the house was occupied by a respectable family of mulattoes who had chambre garnie to let. They had been living there for 6 months and knew absolutely nothing of a Mademoiselle Rise. In fact, they knew nothing of any of their neighbors. Their lodgers were all people of the highest distinction, they assured Edna. She did not linger to discuss class distinctions with Madame Poupon, but hastened to a neighboring grocery store, feeling sure that Mademoiselle would have left her address with the proprietor. He knew Mademoiselle Rise a good deal better than he wanted to know her, he informed his questioner. In truth, he did not want to know her at all, or anything concerning her, the most disagreeable and unpopular woman who ever lived in Bienville Street. He thanked heaven she had left the neighborhood, and was equally thankful that he did not know where she had gone. Edna's desire to see Mademoiselle Rise had increased tenfold since these unlooked-for obstacles had arisen to thwart it. She was wondering who would give her the information she sought. Then it suddenly occurred to her that Madame Lebrun would be the one most likely to do so. She knew it was useless to ask Madame Ratignolle, who was on the most distant terms with the musician, and preferred to know nothing concerning her. She had once been almost as emphatic in expressing herself upon the subject as the corner grocer. Edna knew that Madame Lebrun had returned to the city, for it was the middle of November, and she also knew where the Lebruns lived, on Chartres Street. Their home from the outside looked like a prison, with iron bars before the door and lower windows. The iron bars were a relic of the old regime, and no one had ever thought of dislodging them. At the side was a high fence enclosing the garden. A gate or door opening upon the street was locked. Edna rang the bell at the side garden gate and stood upon the banquette, waiting to be admitted. It was Victor who opened the gate for her. A black woman, wiping her hands upon her apron, was close at his heels. Before she saw them, Edna could hear them in altercation, the woman, plainly an anomaly, claiming the right to be allowed to perform her duties, one of which was to answer the bell. Victor was surprised and delighted to see Mrs. Pontellier, and he made no attempt to conceal either his astonishment or his delight. He was a dark-browed, good-looking youngster of 19, greatly resembling his mother, but with 10 times her impetuosity. He instructed the black woman to go at once and inform Madame Lebrun that Mrs. Pontellier desired to see her. The woman grumbled a refusal to do part of her duty when she had not been permitted to do it all, and started back to her interrupted task of weeding the garden. Whereupon Victor administered a rebuke in the form of a volley of abuse, which, owing to its rapidity and incoherence, was all but incomprehensible to Edna. Whatever it was, the rebuke was convincing, for the woman dropped her hoe and went mumbling into the house. Edna did not wish to enter. It was very pleasant there on the side porch, where there were chairs, a wicker lounge, and a small table. She seated herself, for she was tired from her long tramp, and she began to rock gently and smooth out the folds of her silk parasol. Victor drew up his chair beside her. He at once explained that the black woman's offensive conduct was all due to imperfect training, and he was not there to take her in hand. He had only come up from the island the morning before, and expected to return next day. He stayed all winter at the island. He lived there and kept the place in order and got things ready for the summer visitors. But a man needed occasional relaxation, he informed Mrs. Pontellier, and every now and again he drummed up a pretext to bring him to the city. My, but he had had a time of it the evening before. He wouldn't want his mother to know, and he began to talk in a whisper. He was scintillant with recollections. Of course, he couldn't think of telling Mrs. Pontellier all about it, she being a woman and not comprehending such things. But it all began with a girl peeping and smiling at him through the shutters as he passed by. Oh, but she was a beauty. Certainly, he smiled back, and went up and talked to her. Mrs. Pontellier did not know him if she supposed he was one to let an opportunity like that escape him. Despite herself, the youngster amused her. She must have betrayed in her look some degree of interest or entertainment. The boy grew more daring, and Mrs. Pontellier might have found herself, in a little while, listening to a highly colored story, but for the timely appearance of Madame Lebrun.
That lady was still clad in white, according to her custom of the summer. Her eyes beamed an effusive welcome. Would not Mrs. Pontellier go inside? Would she partake of some refreshments? Why had she not been there before? How was that dear Mr. Pontellier, and how were those sweet children? Had Mrs. Pontellier ever known such a warm November? Victor went and reclined on the wicker lounge behind his mother's chair, where he commanded a view of Edna's face. He had taken her parasol from her hands while he spoke to her, and he now lifted it and twirled it above him as he lay on his back. When Madame Lebrun complained that it was so dull coming back to the city, that she saw so few people now, that even Victor, when he came up from the island for a day or two, had so much to occupy him and engage his time, then it was that the youth went into contortions on the lounge and winked mischievously at Edna. She somehow felt like a confederate in crime, and tried to look severe and disapproving. There had been but two letters from Robert, with little in them, they told her. Victor said it was really not worthwhile to go inside for the letters, when his mother entreated him to go in search of them. He remembered the contents, which in truth he rattled off very glibly when put to the test. One letter was written from Vera Cruz, and the other from the City of Mexico. He had met Montel, who was doing everything toward his advancement. So far, the financial situation was no improvement over the one he had left in New Orleans, but of course the prospects were vastly better. He wrote of the City of Mexico, the buildings, the people and their habits, the conditions of life which he found there. He sent his love to the family. He enclosed a check to his mother and hoped she would affectionately remember him to all his friends. That was about the substance of the two letters. Edna felt that if there had been a message for her, she would have received it. The despondent frame of mind in which she had left home began again to overtake her, and she remembered that she wished to find Mademoiselle Rise. Madame Lebrun knew where Mademoiselle Rise lived. She gave Edna the address, regretting that she would not consent to stay and spend the remainder of the afternoon and pay a visit to Mademoiselle Rise some other day. The afternoon was already well advanced. Victor escorted her out upon the banquette, lifted her parasol, and held it over her while he walked to the car with her. He entreated her to bear in mind that the disclosures of the afternoon were strictly confidential. She laughed and bantered him a little, remembering too late that she should have been dignified and reserved. "How handsome Mrs. Pontellier looked," said Madame Lebrun to her son.
"Ravishing," he admitted. "The city atmosphere has improved her. Some way she doesn't seem like the same woman."
This book is continued on Disc 3.